And welcome to Tuesday's programme. How you doing? What sort of a bank holiday weekend have you had? What sort of Easter have you had? Are you in good form? We've had it all here in Salford today. Snow flurries we've had, and it's very, very cold. But we've got each other. Tuesday's programme, the 6th of April 2021. Let's do it. Do tweet me. It's at BBG Richie.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, a little bit later on in this programme, I will be joined by Matt Campbell, an old friend of mine. It's been a long time since Matt was on the programme. Matt is, he spent the best part of 20 years along with his family campaigning for justice for his brother Jeff. Jeff was killed on September the 11th, 2001. He was at the World Trade Centre that morning for a conference, and his family has never accepted the official version of what happened to Jeff and continued to campaign on his behalf. And there is fairly substantial news there. So I'm looking forward to catching up with Matt Campbell. That'll be a bit later on in the programme. Before that, I'll be rounding up the day's news with you for company. Thanks for joining me. Tuesdays. the bank holiday weekend throws us, doesn't it? Yeah, it is Tuesday. It is Dean's Tag. It is indeed. Right, Dean's Tag. Isn't it? Yeah, that's right. Dean's Tag, yeah. De Mort, we say, in God's country. So, nice bank holiday weekend. I was with you on Sunday for the old Melodies thing. But by and large, I got out and about, went to a couple of parks, did our thing. Freezing today. Brass monkeys. Couldn't believe it when I left the house this morning very early. I was out the door about 6:10. Snow flurries and all. Snow flurries. And I was thinking of you yesterday, because I think of you. I was running down Regent Road into Manchester. Wasn't breaking any records now. More chance of breaking me neck than breaking a record. Especially Bank Holiday Monday. I was jogging as opposed to running, if I'm to be honest about it, right? Snail's pace kind of a thing. And I had talk radio on in the headphones. Best of a bad lot, don't you know? I've given up listening to music because it's dangerous. When you're deaf, and I've been half deaf for years, it's dangerous to be running on Manchester and Salford's roads with music blaring in your earpieces because you might just get knocked down. I hope I don't get knocked down in the near future because this will become a very ironic programme. But anyway, so I've taken to listen to talk radio and BBC Radio 5 Live, which I ordinarily listen to earlier when I'm in the parks with my canine companion. So yesterday I had a bit of talk radio on, best of a bad lot, as I've said, and Mike Graham had Peter Hitchens on of the Mail Online, Daily Mail. Peter Hitchens, you know who he is. It's a weekly slot. And listening to it just reinforced for me what I have believed and have been preaching. I know you don't like preachers, I'm not a preacher, but it reinforced what I've believed and have been saying for many, many years. And it didn't make me feel too good now. That basically all mainstream media is the same, a bit like politics. You have your lefty channels and you have your conservative ones, like talk radio, for example. Pressure valves. If society is a boiler, these stations like talk radio are pressure valves. You know, tune in and hear somebody tell you pretty much what you already know. So talk radio listeners tune in and they hear Julia Hartley Brewer and Mike Graham moaning about the lockdown and saying how sinister it is and how Orwellian all of it is. And the data says we should be released from lockdown. Why is Johnson delaying it? So on, so on, so on. The problem with that, of course, is, and I'm not picking on talk radio now, it's just a handy one, it starts from the position that these are bad policy decisions, or the government is being overly cautious, or that Boris Johnson is being overly reliant on the Scientific Advisory Group on Emergencies, or SAGE. And this is the old bad management theory. And this is what props up the left-right paradigm, not just in the world of politics, where you go and vote for these clowns, if that's your thing, but also in radio and television programmes. This is what props it all up. The old bad man management theory. Not man management, just management. Bad management. Bad politics. Bad data. Because it can't be any more sinister than that, really, can it? It can't, really. Because politicians are just too thick, aren't they, for this to be part of a concerted plan to create a dystopian world. Too stupid, aren't they? And talk of George Soros and Bill Gates, and that's just old silly conspiracy theory, isn't it? Bad management. But of course, bad management presupposes that Johnson and Hancock are in fact in charge. So Julia, Hartley Brewer and Mike Graham and all the rest of them, well, they're happy to take the vaccines and then moan about the masks and the distancing and the lockdowns. And why can't I go to the pub? I've had my vaccines, goddammit. To hell with those who don't want them. I want to go to the pub. This is very, very, very draconian. So these programmes act as a kind of a pressure valve. It's a safe space for people to go and moan and criticise the lockdown and how draconian it is. Very safe space, isn't it, to do that in. Safe because you never have to really ask what's really going on or challenge yourself as to what you might need to do about it. So they're very safe. On the one hand, it sounds like these people are agreeing with you and they see it for what it is, but they don't. Or they do, and they don't want to get into it. Everybody stays in a safe space because the producers and the presenters are never going to go down the rabbit hole. Well, what if something else is going on? Who is Bill Gates? Why is he the single biggest contributor to the World Health Organization's kitty? Why is he? Why has he spent even so many billions of dollars with universities all over the world? What is Gavi and CEPI? What is the MHRA really? That's the Medicines Healthcare Regulatory Authority in England, by the way. These are questions you don't really want to be asking, so stay in a safe space. I'll stay in my safe space and I'll just bitch about the fact that there's no need for any lockdown. There's no need for it, really. We've had our vaccines, you know? We've had our vaccines and we've worn the masks for a year. Why, pray tell, why is it taking so long for us to get back to normality? And you don't have to then do any more digging. Just go and, you know, be in your safe space with your television or radio presenter of choice, don't you know? I've got so much to talk about with you between now and 6 o'clock. Then it's Matt Campbell. The Richie Allen Show for Tuesday. Right then, Simple Minds, Somewhere, Somehow, Summertime, Someplace. I think that's what it's called anyway. I made a bags of that, did I? Ah, sure, there's a week for making a bags of stuff. Good evening, welcome to the programme. Thanks for your tweets already. BBG Richie is the Twitter handle. I'll be reading them out as I go along. So do send them in. Thank you. Good stuff. Let's move on then. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about this because I was moved this morning to talk about what's happened to this country in the last 12 months. And I thought I would try and articulate that in a piece on the website. So if you haven't checked it out, do go to richieallen.co.uk. And there is an article there cheekily entitled "Pol Potbelly Turned the UK into a Totalitarian State in a Year." And it's basically a quick rundown of the last 12 months. Okay, on the day that the government is asking citizens to prove that they're not infected, the onus is on you now, dear listener. Did you know that? The onus is on you now to prove that you're not a threat to anybody and that you're not carrying any dirty germs. And you will pretty soon be asked to carry a license, basically, a license. That's what it is to all intents and purposes, to allow you to participate in society. All of this now, today, everything today was geared around media coverage of the testing, the passports, and the, yeah, that's pretty much it, isn't it? Yeah, the testing, the twice weekly testing. and coronavirus passports or COVID certificates. And it got me thinking about where we are today. And I thought, could I put it down on the website in a way that even the skeptics, people who think that there's good enough reason for us to be locking ourselves down, there's good enough reason for us all to be taking a vaccine, could I articulate it in a way that they might understand that something very, very wrong is taking place, something very, very sinister. And basically, I came up with a few, you know, irrefutable points. You can't leave the country without a valid reason now. And if you don't have one, you could be fined thousands of pounds. We saw on Friday, churchgoers observing Good Friday, the Stations of the Cross and all of that, were confronted by tooled up police officers who told them to get out and fined them for worshipping. You can't or haven't been able to for a year now, been able to go where you want and meet who you want to meet, which has resulted in tens of thousands of seniors being condemned to die in care homes for their own protection. Children, a lot of talk today about mental health on UK television and radio. Children have been terrorised by the Don't Kill Granny message and advertising campaign. And because they've been locked up and kept away from their friends for over a year, and because they've been subjected to all of this nonsense, psychologists are warning, and even warning on mainstream media, that there is a mental health tsunami coming down the line. Children are being destroyed, basically. Business owners told to shut their doors and to stand by while the companies collapse, while tens of thousands, in fact millions, will lose their jobs as a result. And as we saw here in Manchester, or in Greater Manchester, when some shop owners disobeyed, they were handcuffed, arrested and taken to their local police station to be fined. The Coronavirus Act was extended, was renewed until October. It contains provisions within it that allows a public health officer to come and take you from your home if it is suspected that you are infected but that you are not cooperating with self-isolation orders. This is a fact. Extended until October, despite the fact that, well, there's nothing really going on in the hospitals and that deaths are non-existent. And in fact, would you believe, and I can prove this, deaths for any reason at all are lower in this year, calendar year 2021, so far than in the same period last year. That's a fact. It's an absolute fact. So these are the things that are happening, and they seem to be gathering pace now as we speak. And we're going to talk about that now for the next few minutes. You're with the Richie Allen Show, live from Salford, and it's good to be with you. So let's talk about the AstraZeneca vaccine then, which you might have come across this today. Again, I've written about this on richieallen.co.uk. Let's hear Sky News this afternoon. And I think it's Sam Washington, the presenter.
Good afternoon. The UK's medicines regulator is considering restricting the Oxford AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine in young people. That's over fears of rare blood clots. The head of the European Medicine Agency's vaccine strategy says he believes there is an association between the Oxford jab and blood clots, and that in some age groups, the risks of the jab may outweigh the benefits. The EMA has told Sky News that its safety committee will issue guidance either tomorrow or Thursday.
Right, this is Marco Cavalieri. He's the head of vaccines at the European Medicines Agency, or the EMA. Now, this morning, he told an Italian newspaper called Il Messaggero, he told him there is a clear link between the Oxford AstraZeneca jab and blood clotting. He said his team is still trying to figure out how the jab is triggering the clots, but it is triggering the clots. And he said to the newspaper, in the next few hours, we will say that there is a connection, but we still have to understand how this happens. We are trying to get a precise picture of what is happening to define in detail this syndrome due to the vaccine. Among the vaccinated, there are more cases of cerebral thrombosis among young people than we would expect. I don't know about you, dear listener, but that sounds pretty serious to me. What does Boris Johnson think of it?
The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. I think that the best thing people should do is look at what the MHRA say, our independent regulator. That's why we have them. That's why they're independent. And their advice to people is to keep going out there, get your second jab.
Sorry for the abrupt cut there. Get your jab. That's the advice. Get the jab. No thanks. Very interesting article in the Mail today. I read all the papers, by the way. Don't judge me on reading the Mail. I read them all, every one of them. The pathologist Dr. John Lee, who often appears on talk radio, says correctly that there is no evidence of asymptomatic transmission. And this is, again, one of the main anchors of this flimsy house of cards. This is a king of clubs card. This notion that healthy people like you and me might actually have the virus and could be unwittingly passing it on to somebody else. This is bollocks. It is horse manure. It is absolutely, it's vintage. It's vintage horse manure, this. There is no evidence of it. And according to the British Medical Journal, very, very, very respected tome, very respected, I suppose, what you would call industry magazine, where doctors and scientists and nurses write about their experiences and publish their papers, the BMJ, it's been around since the 19th century. It said, and it is true, listen up because this is important, a city-wide prevalence study of almost 10 million people in Wuhan found no evidence whatsoever of asymptomatic transmission. None. It's a fantasy. So before you start throwing the anti-Chinese stuff at me, I've got no time for China, personally, or the way of life in China, or the Chinese government. Of course I don't. But the Chinese claim of studying 10 million people and finding no evidence of asymptomatic transmission, that has been peer-reviewed and accepted by Western science journals and Western scientists. It's a fantasy. It's a fantasy, and they want every single one of us, me, you, your children, our nieces and nephews, to self-test twice a week, healthy people, when they know that asymptomatic transmission is a nonsense. It's bullshit. It doesn't happen. End of story. Again, that's one of the big cards in the flimsy house of cards, the king of clubs, that one. Asymptomatic transmission. Don't hold your breath waiting for a UK television presenter to ask these tyrants any questions about asymptomatic transmission. Now, the passports then. What a stir this has caused today. Ministers jumping in and out of television and radio shows this morning, mid-morning, lunchtime, to talk up the benefits of COVID certificates or COVID passports. Here's the Prime Minister again. This time he was in Macclesfield. The bastard was just down the road. I could have driven down there and custard pied the bejesus out of him. He'd probably have eaten them. Here he is, revaxed passports.
Well, very important to stress that the best thing of all is to vaccinate our population, get everybody out, getting the jab. That's the key thing, and that's what I would advocate, number one. The second point, obviously, is that on Monday, on the 12th, shops are going to be open, outdoor pub, beer gardens, outdoor restaurants and so on. You don't need anything, any kind of certificate to go then. You won't need anything on May the 17th when we open up indoor hospitality, in restaurants, indoor pubs, no question anything then. What, of course, we're looking at is what several other countries are looking at, and that's the role of vaccination passports for overseas travel. I think that is going to be a fact of life, probably. A lot of other countries are looking at that. I think we're also going to look at the role of a number of signals that you can give that you're not contagious. So, first of all, your immunity, if you've had it, that's going to be important. Number two, Vaccination will be useful, but don't forget also the importance of testing.
Testing.
So from the 9th, from Friday, everybody can get free lateral flow tests also on the NHS.
And yes, on Friday, if you so choose, you can have some free lateral flow tests on the NHS. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you want some? Listen to what he said again. This is the big sea change now. And I suppose if you listen to programmes like this, you will understand this. But this will go over a lot of people's heads. You know, those who read the Daily Mail, who go out and buy it, or The Sun, or The Mirror, listen to this.
Of signals that you can give that you're not contagious. So, first of all...
Yeah, we want to provide you with the means for you to provide us with signals that you are not contagious. Signals that you are not contagious. Well, I'm up and about and I'm walking around as I ordinarily do, going about my business as I would do any other day. That's signal enough that I'm okay. Mind your own fucking business. How about them apples? Signals that you can provide to us to show that you are healthy. He said this over the weekend. I talked about it online. You're going to have to prove to us. You'll have to prove to us that you're healthy. Prove to us that you're not contagious.
The role of a number of signals that you can give that you're not contagious. So, first of all, your immunity.
Your immunity and all of that. So, from Friday, if you feel so inclined, you can contact the NHS and it will provide you with enough lateral flow tests to last you for the rest of your life so that you can test yourself twice a week like a Muppet. Like a Muppet. When there's nothing wrong with you. And wait for somebody to come and collect it from your front door in order for you to be given permission to go to the supermarket or to go to the cinema or maybe to get on a plane. This is where we are now. Not funny, this stuff, is it? That's Johnson. Conservative Party MP Henry Smith, he's a Tory MP for Crawley, was on Talk Radio this morning. He said this.
Well, I would be very nervous about the prospect of health data being shared. I think that is something which is a line of civil liberties that would be unacceptably crossed if that were the case. But I was pleased that there seems to be some rowing back from the suggestion that I think we heard towards the end of last week that you'll need a vaccine passport or certificate to go to the pub or to certain shops. Seems to me that they are now talking about larger venues. I think the FA Cup was mentioned. So I do think it's important that we all stand up and we say that, understand that these are unprecedented times, these are massive challenges that the country is facing, but the way to recover isn't to damage our ancient civil liberties. The way to do that is to continue with these successful vaccination programs so that we can get back to normal and get our economy growing again.
Yeah, Tory MP Henry Smith, Crawley there. The Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. Tuesday's programme. Still with Heidi Klum. Izzy Seal, you might be. Great song, that. Crazy. Can't remember what year. 91, was it? 91, 92, I can't remember. It's the Alzheimer's. Early onset dementia, that's the one. Kate Ferguson, who, if I remember correctly, I'm going to look a bit stupid now, is a political editor at The Sun, is she? Is she a reporter or a political editor at The Sun, Kate Ferguson, is reporting that the government confirms that face masks will carry on being compulsory in secondary schools after Easter. She's wrong. They are not compulsory. It is advice. It's guidance. It's not compulsory. Children cannot be compelled to wear masks in classrooms. They cannot be compelled to do so. I know that some schools are leaning very heavily on the youngsters to comply. But it's not compulsory. Thanks, Charlie, for tweeting that to me. I've had a great Easter, thank you, to those of you asking me. I've had a nice long weekend. It's been pretty cool. Enjoyed my Sunday dinner, so I did the oft-mentioned future missus while she was firing on all cylinders. Eh? That's the way it should be. Hi to Bill, you misogynistic Baxter. Hi to Bill. Richie, if I'm sick, I'll stay home. I'll stay in bed if I'm bad enough. I'll call the doctor or make an appointment, but I will not attempt to prove to anybody that I am not sick. Well done, Bill. Good man. Fanula Murphy, how you doing, Fanula? Connors of tea. I'm so glad, Richie, I belong in your tribe. I don't have any tribe, Fanula, but thank you. Thanks for the lovely message. Hope you had a good Easter as well. And Freedom Jack says, Richie, have you seen this about 26 centres? The government announced today that it's rolling out 26 mental health centres, which will provide help for new expectant and bereaved mothers. I did catch a snippet of a BBC report, which is a bit sinister. It showed some expectant mothers and some mothers who had just given birth going to talk with counsellors. And the guy doing the voiceover for the BBC, the reporter, he said that these clinics, these 26 clinics, will be a one-stop shop, basically, where all manner of health advice will be offered to mothers. I didn't like the sounds of it, but I haven't delved too deeply into it today. Thank you for that, Freedom Jack. Rich says, ironically, the lateral flow test will have been manufactured in China. Well, my wife's was, says Rich. Thank you, Rich. Hi to Angela, who says, Boris needs to prove he's healthy. Look at him. Well, I did put a post on Facebook yesterday that was a little bit crass, not very subtle, and probably not very funny. But if Johnson submits himself for chlamydia and gonorrhea tests twice a week, the dirty bastard who can't keep it in his trousers. If he does twice a week for the rest of his life, I might consider having the one, just the one, lateral flow test. John in Austin in Texas says, Richie, get your arse down to Macclesfield. Johnson might still be there. But I'm a lover, not a fighter, John. I don't even think I'd throw a pie at him, to be honest. Would I? I might do. There was a time. Ewan says, Richie, good evening. Been doing online training courses at work today. I'd rather slide down sandpaper helter-skelter on my bare arse than do that again. Online courses, huh? Ah, sure, it's the way of the world now. Online everything. Hi to Patricia, who says, from the start, the available research has been rather consistent. Mask wearing does not reduce the prevalence of viral illness, and asymptomatic spread is exceedingly rare, if not non-existent. Dr. Merkula, Joseph Merkula, has said as such. I think he'll be on the programme this month, I think. I think he will be. I think he might be booked in. Might be booked in. Booked in. Hi to David King. Hi to John Hardyman. Right, it's time to move on and talk about what? I have no idea. Let's have a look at my bullet points. Where are we going next? Ashering, you have to laugh. LBC has a presenter called James O'Brien. Stop groaning. I can hear you from here. Shut up, I said. O'Brien wants the vaccine passports and he wants us all to be vaccinated. He does. He wants us all to be vaccinated, does James O'Brien.
Get the bloody jab.
That's him.
Get the bloody jab.
Get the bloody jab. Now, we know James is the worst radio presenter in the world, the most pretentious man that ever surfed the airwaves. Hey, coincidentally, on the day that O'Brien was pushing the vaccine passports, he got a call from a man in a hospital bed who's been treated for COVID. What a coincidence. The man rang in, his name is Darren, to tell us to accept the passports. Accept them. Think of me in me hospital bed, he said. Alrighty. So yeah, James O'Brien, Darren, LBC, Darren from his hospital bed. You gotta do this. God be with the days.
I know I am, I'm sure I am. He's H-A-P-P-Y.
I'm HAPPY. Remember Peter Bowles? I hope I got that name right. Remember Peter Bowles was in that Only When I Laugh. God be with the days. Anyway, James O'Brien and sick man Darren from sick hospital bed with the COVID, don't you know?
I'm actually lying in the COVID ward as we speak.
Oh, my mate. I'm so sorry to hear that.
I don't know if you remember me. I'm Charlie Pasek's grandson.
He's Charlie Pasek's grandson.
Oh, of course I do, Darren. Yeah.
Ryan, bastard, you have no memory whatsoever of him, O'Brien.
I'm sorry to hear that, mate. How are you doing?
I got pneumonia and was then tested positive for COVID on Friday. And it's a life-changing experience. Oh, let me put it this way.
Have they got it? Are you getting looked after?
Yeah, I'm on the mend. And,
oh, thank goodness.
It's just, it's very,
yeah,
it brings you down to earth when you...
You're O'Brien. Yeah, I know. He's so sensitive, isn't he?
It's very,
it brings you
down to earth when you're a 39-year-old, fitting, strong, healthy lad, can't even brush his own teeth.
What? He can't even brush his own teeth? But he can call a radio station. And what was that about pneumonia?
I got pneumonia and was then tested positive for COVID on Friday.
Yeah.
I got pneumonia and was then tested positive for COVID on Friday.
On Friday.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah, it's fairly fuckery. Listen to James act like he's all broken up for poor Darren.
Just completely wiped you
exhausted.
Out. Completely wiped you out.
But I just don't understand the fear of call them a passport, call them a certificate, call them...
Tyranny is what I'd call them.
Whatever you want.
Tyranny.
Why don't we just call it peace of mind? Just...
I
don't want anyone...
To end up like you?
I do or don't know. To feel like this. And I think that's the, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse of COVID, is it doesn't put everybody in hospital like it has done me.
No.
And it hasn't, you know, it has with
the voice on O'Brien.
Everyone else. Some people get it and it seems they just brush it off. I don't want anyone to get to a point like I've been where you can't even get yourself dressed. To be honest, if you just have a little bit of paper to show to get in to a...
You're a papier and bitter.
...pub.
Yeah.
So be it. So what? They'll go just as quickly as they arrive.
Sure they will.
6 months down the line.
We have to presume that. Some people say they won't. They'll smuggle it in under the cloak of COVID. But then you sort of wonder why.
Because these people, I mean, Don Jolly's not been out of their village comment made me giggle, which then made me cough.
Oh, no. Because slumming Don Jolly hurting people who are already suffering enough, honestly.
Yeah. Because obviously his reply is, you know, referring to them as idiots. But,
it seems like a no-brainer.
It's like a no-brainer.
Get the bloody jab.
It's a no-brainer. It's a no-brainer. James O'Brien and Darren there. Yeah, get your jab, then get your passport. It's a no-brainer. And then Darren delivers the line that he'd been rehearsing all morning, what we call the money shot. You ready? You ready? The money shot.
Yeah. It seems like a no-brainer. It seems like a no-brainer.
It does to me because it's not... COVID-19 takes away your civil liberties, trust me.
Brilliant. That's brilliant, that. That's powerfully delivered. That's absolutely gorgeous.
It's not... COVID-19 takes away your civil liberties, trust me. That takes away your liberties.
Gosh, I hadn't thought of it that way, Rand.
Yes, James O'Brien, LBC with Darren. Sounded rehearsed to me, but what the hell do I know? It's at BBG Richie on Twitter. That's my Twitter handle. Please... Please, go on, I'll do it one more time. I should have finished with it, to be honest, because it's just great. It's so long since I heard it. Eh? If you're under 40, you won't have a clue what that is.
I know I am, I'm sure I am. He's H-A-P-P.
Why? Peter Bowles, get in there. I think Jean Anne worked with Peter Bowles back in the day. Might well have done. I'm pretty sure she has, actually. Alan says, been listening. Driving home in a snow, winter, heavy shower, flurries, flurries. It's not a blizzard. Don't exaggerate it now. It's not a blizzard. It's a flurry of snow. Hi to Jason, who says, he sounds effing healthy, Richie. This guy. I don't know if he sounds healthy. But he doesn't sound sincere, to be honest. But hell, what do I know? I might get sued. That's what might happen. Hi to Alucard, who says, Richard, in fact, Richard says, I wonder how the first man, William Shakespeare, is doing. Handycock got a fright, got a right fucking laugh out of that one. Yes, I'm sorry for screwing up your tweet there. I don't know what's going on. Angela says, hey, Richie, is it just me? Or if you were in hospital with severe pneumonia, would you be able to talk on the radio? Like this? He's not ill, says Angela. Well, first of all, the most important part of that equation is that he's in hospital with pneumonia. Pneumonia. I came into hospital with pneumonia. Then I tested positive for COVID. Captain Tom. It happened to Captain Tom too, didn't it? Hi to James. James Lindsdale. How you doing, James? James Dinsdale. Right, I've got to move on to so much to get through. Yes. Right, okay. Here we go. Yes, James O'Brien is a bell end. I know. I said the most insincere man on radio, the worst presenter that ever surfed the airwaves, but there you go. We're never going back to normal, you know that now, you do. You want to hear three geeks, three proper geeks? I'm talking pencil pouches in shirt, breast pocket geek, you know. I'm talking staying home playing Dungeons and Dragons on your prom night geek, right? Okay, big push today. Big push that we're not going back to normal ever. Every radio channel, every television station featured a man or a woman today who was brought on to remind us that we're not going back to normal. Here's a guy called Mark Jitt, J-I-T, London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, I think. Epidemiologist, I think. He was on Sky News. Now, he was brought on because you might know this, you might not know this. He's one of a number of scientists who wrote to the government over the weekend to warn the government that if they stick with their roadmap, there will be a massive wave of infections and hospitalizations in the late summer. You may have seen this. Right? I'm not going to play the fuckery jingle. Johnson is reopening at a snail's pace. He doesn't want to. He's making excuses not to. And you've got a bunch of geeks saying, you're going too fast. You'll kill us all. This is vaudeville. Professor Mark Jitt is one of these idiots. Here he is on Sky News with Sam Washington.
Well, thanks for having me. The first thing is this, the modelling led also by my colleagues, Dr. Nick Davies and Dr. Rosanna Barnard. One thing I want to emphasise is that this modelling shows scenarios rather than actual predictions. So what actually happens depends on many things that we don't know yet about how the vaccines will act, about how people's behaviour will change over the next couple of months. But in the worst case scenario, this could lead to a very large wave of both cases and hospitalizations and ultimately deaths in the late summer.
So we're talking July, August, are we? And are we talking the same sort of level of hospital admissions as we saw a year ago or as we saw at the start of this year?
Softball questions from Sam Washington there. Rather than take the guy apart at the knees for his nonsense, she's teeing him up for another softball answer.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Well, it's difficult to predict right now because what we don't...
Well, why don't you keep your fucking mouth shut then? If it's difficult to predict, why don't you shut up and stop talking about massive waves and spikes in the summer and hospitalizations when you really can't tell your arse from your elbow, man? You don't know, really. This hasn't even been modelled. You're just making it up, you and your pals.
Don't know is several things. We do know that lots of people are getting vaccinated and that should protect us, protect many people from getting severely sick and dying. But what we don't know is how people's behaviour will be in this summer. For instance, last summer, when most restrictions were lifted, people still continued to do things like wear masks, wash their hands, keep some sort of physical distancing from each other, even though most restrictions on, for instance, going to the shops, going to the pub were lifted. So if,
see what he's saying there? Last summer, when we opened up again, people kept the masks and kept to the distancing. Now, I can testify to this because last August, I spent a week in the Lake District with my better half and our canine chums. And yes, everybody did. People were doing everything they could to avoid one another, and everybody was wearing the damn masks. This guy is worried, as are his pals, that this summer we might just ditch the masks and the distancing because lots and lots of people have been vaccinated. And remember, you know this and I know this, the masks and the distancing are meant to be with us forever. Forever. Not just for COVID or whatever that is.
If that happens, then we might not see this huge surge. But actually, if people's behavior goes back to where it was February last year, for instance, before we had this coronavirus really start to change behavior in the UK, then that could lead to a lot of transmission and eventually hospitalizations and deaths.
Is human behaviour and fatigue over the restrictions, is that the only thing that's factoring into what you've described as a pessimistic scenario? Or are you also factoring in things to do with the efficacy of the vaccines themselves?
Right. OK. What does he say to that then?
Yeah, that's also important. We do know that the vaccines we're using do protect very well, not perfectly, but very well against severe disease and death. They don't protect so well against mild disease, so people can still get infected and have very mild disease or maybe not even have any symptoms. And so
they keep changing the goalposts all the time, don't they? So now it's a case of, we know the vaccines protect very well against serious disease, but they don't protect very well against mild disease, right? They're going to be spinning this yarn a lot now in the coming days.
And have very mild disease or maybe not even have any symptoms and so not even realise they're infected and transmit. So the vaccine...
Bullshit. He said the vaccine doesn't do well against mild symptoms. So the vaccine will protect you against bad disease, he says, but it won't protect you against mild disease and it won't do anything for the asymptomatic. He's basically said that on a national television news channel and she hasn't ripped him apart. Listen to what he says
again.
Get
infected and have very mild disease or maybe not even have any symptoms and so not even realise they're infected and transmit. So the vaccine doesn't protect so well against infection.
The vaccine doesn't protect so well against infection, he says. The vaccines don't protect against infection.
The vaccine doesn't protect so well against infection.
It's astonishing this, isn't it? And this is what they're going to push and push and push and push and push. Well, the vaccines are not really dealing with this coronavirus, really. You know, we thought they would, but all they do really is stop really, really bad disease. But we can't ignore how serious mild disease is. And we also can't ignore those people who've got no symptoms at all, but might have the virus. So we've got to keep with the masks and the distancing and the mass testing forever and ever and ever. That's what this guy is saying.
So there could be actually a lot of transmission. And so what we want to know is, will the fact that the vaccine is preventing most of these people from actually getting very severe disease or dying, will that be enough to keep hospitalizations down? And will that be enough to keep death down? And that's something we're monitoring very closely as more people get vaccinated and when we see how well the vaccine does.
The media could end this in 5 minutes. A decent presenter would eviscerate this guy, but she doesn't. This is what she says next.
And Professor Jit, when you're looking at these scenarios, as you prefer to call them, and the pessimistic scenarios, is there anything in that which says that you could have had a vaccine, you could have had your two doses of the vaccine, and you could still end up in hospital and you could possibly still die?
That's astonishing, isn't it? Isn't that absolutely mind-boggling, isn't it?
You could have had a vaccine, you could have had your two doses of the vaccine and you could still end up in hospital and you could possibly still die.
Wow. Isn't it true that you could have the vaccine, you could have both your doses, but you still could end up in hospital and die, says the so-called journalist. Right?
Well, these vaccines work very well, especially against severe disease, but very well is not 100%. So they, you know, they'll give you 90, 95, maybe even 97%. 5% protection against severe disease. And that's great, but there's still that small chance that they won't work in a small percentage of people. But when you multiply that, you know, few percent across the whole population, that does end up with a lot of possible people getting severe disease.
Wow. And there you have it. So the vaccine prevents even against, for most people, it prevents against serious disease. But for 2 or 3% of people who get it, it won't prevent them getting severe disease. If you add all that up or multiply those numbers, that's still an enormous amount of people that can get severe disease. Therefore, we shouldn't release ourselves from lockdown at all. And this guy and a bunch of other scientists have written to the government to say, you're moving too fast out of lockdown. Right? Right. Okay. You see where this is going, you do? I know you're not stupid. Same programme, presenter Sam Washington with Peter Drobak, global health professor, Oxford University. Listen to him.
Well, of course, we've seen a tremendous effort with the vaccine rollout here in the UK. But if you look over the last couple of weeks, the number of new vaccinations does appear to be kind of levelling off a bit. And that appears to be a function of the slowdown in the supply. Now, we're told that this is a temporary slowdown in supply that should be lasting through the month of April and should be picking up thereafter. Very hopeful about that, not least because I'm not too far off in the queue myself, I hope. But it does appear that, you know, that even with the great progress we're making, most people have still only received one dose. If you look at the timeline of when we're going to see, a majority of the population fully vaccinated, we're still looking off into the summer.
Into the summer. So this guy now is exactly the same as the previous professor. He's cautioning against opening up society. He's coming at it from a slightly different angle. Not everybody is going to be vaccinated in time, he's saying, despite the fact that 30 million people have had one dose and more than 5 million people have had two doses. That's not good enough for this guy because the country won't be fully vaccinated until late summer. So he'd prefer that we stayed in the nonsense that we're in now, in the lunatic asylum that we're in now. Business is closed, right? People losing their nuts, right? Their life savings, the businesses that they gave birth to, that they've nurtured, that they've worked on for, in some cases, many, many, many years. Let's scrap all that. No foreign holidays. Let's not let anybody into the country. Let's keep it fairly tight now until the end of the summer. Of course, the problem with that is, once you get to the end of the summer, you're into the autumn, and dickheads like him will then be telling you, it would have been nice to open up now, because nearly everybody's had two doses, but now we're into the variants. Now we're into the variants. This is, well, it's so ridiculous, this. It's maddening to me because any 5 cent radio presenter or television presenter could annihilate these guys, but they choose not to.
Summer, and of course, we have to think about getting to the place where even children can be vaccinated.
He wants children to be vaccinated.
Hopefully beginning as early as autumn, if we really want to reach the high levels of population level immunity, that's going to give us all protection.
Children don't get it. They don't transmit it. It's of no threat to them whatsoever. This bastard wants them to be immunized. She should be ripping him to pieces about the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine because he is an Oxford University professor. But no, he's coming on air to talk about horror stories about vaccinating children, keeping us in lockdown until late summer, until everybody's been vaccinated. But then, oops, oh, I'm really sorry, but now we've got the variants. And the presenter, well,
so we do still,
is absent.
Still have a ways to go yet.
I was interviewing one of the contributors to the report received by the government about a potential third wave.
Mark Chit, whom you just heard.
Wave, that third wave hitting towards the end of the summer. Does that concur with your expectations?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this, Samantha, because this was...
glad you mentioned it. It's part of the script.
I think a bit underreported amongst the developments over the last week or so, the SAGE report, and all of their modeling suggests that another wave is, in their words, highly likely sometime in the late summer or early autumn. And that's on the trajectory that we're on now with current levels of vaccinations and with the kind of proposed roadmap. They sort of said it's a matter of when, not if. The question is just how bad. I think this needs to be a huge note of caution for all of us. We feel pretty good. We've made a lot of progress. The vaccine rollout is going really, really well. Vaccines alone will not be able to protect us in the short term. We still need to have a very comprehensive strategy. So whilst we're pushing as aggressively as possible to get the whole population vaccinated, we still need to think about masking and distancing and hopefully very smart restrictions to ward off another surge. We have to be thinking about not just the weeks ahead, not just about the potential for summer travel. We have to think about what next winter is going to look like when the flu season arrives again. And where
when the flu season arrives again, keep that one in your mind.
Again, and where we're going to be, because we're not yet out of the woods.
Wow, it's very
and her response?
Depressing, isn't it, to start depressing. Thinking about next winter. Dr. Peter Drobak, good to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
But if you did your job, it wouldn't be depressing. It'd be over in a matter of minutes because everything he said was a monstrous lie, easily disproven. And, well, that was Peter Drobak or Drobak, whatever his name is. Adam Finn is a professor of paediatrics at Bristol University. He was on BBC News 24 at the same time talking about how changes to the way we live or the way we have lived during the so-called pandemic might be permanent. And he also talked about the flu being gone as well.
And I think we have to recognise actually that we may well decide that we want to change the way we behave to some extent permanently.
Who's we?
After all, we've managed to get rid of other infections that plague us every year. As a kind of side effect of the social distancing we've done this winter, we've had no flu epidemic, we've had no bronchiolitis epidemic. We've got rid of a lot of these things that cause a lot of illness and death and misery just through these kind of measures. So maybe we'll always be a bit different from how we were before.
Lovely. Change the way we live permanently. And, well, you know, because the way we've lived has seen off the flu. Don't forget the flu is gone. Flu is gone for good.
Fortunately, we don't have flu this season.
There you are.
The only circulating virus in the country at the moment is COVID. So if you have any nasal respiratory symptoms, anything of that nature, it's COVID until proven otherwise.
Fortunately, we don't have flu this season.
No flu. Flu is gone. Flu is gone. Flu is gone away. It's coming up for 2 minutes to 6 o'clock. You're with the Richie Allen Show for Tuesday, April 6th, 2021, with me, the BBG. I'm in Salford, where it's been a bright but very chilly day thus far. Let me know how you are. Thanks for your tweets so far in the programme. Don't forget, very soon, Matt Campbell. It's been a long time since Matt was on the programme. Matt and his family have been campaigning for justice for Matt's brother, Jeff, who was only 31, God love him, when he was killed at the World Trade Center on that fateful day back in 2001, September the 11th. So we're going to talk to Matt about that. I came across a brilliant piece in the Mail by Sue Reid about what the family has been doing of late. So I've invited Matt back on the programme. He'll join me soon. Do you want to laugh, do you, before we move on? I'm going to stay with Sky News just for a moment. Sky has introduced a brand new daily news programme, which is all about climate change. It's all about climate change. And it'll be presented by Anna Jones. And every single day on Sky News, presumably Monday to Friday, you'll get a report on the damage being done by climate change. I'm not making it up. It's true. And it plays into a lot of what we've been talking about earlier on in the programme, about the future ways which we'll be expected to live. Anna Jones, but here's the same presenter, Sam Washington, basically promoting this programme today on Sky.
Now, mark your diaries, because tomorrow Sky News will launch the UK's first ever daily news programme entirely dedicated to climate change. It's hosted by Anna Jones. The Daily Climate Show will follow Sky News' correspondents as they investigate how global warming is changing our landscape and how we all live our lives. Dan Whitehead has been taking a look at what you can expect.
Are we now spiralling into a climate crisis which cannot be avoided?
It is a climate emergency that's impacting lives around the world. As leaders prepare to tackle the crisis at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Sky News is launching a new programme, the first daily primetime show dedicated to climate change.
This is the Daily Climate Show, and here's what we're looking at in the programme.
The show will feature forensic, data-led journalism.
So there's that figure right there, where we are at this moment.
Well, we really want to put people and we want to put data right at the heart of the show. Even when you're on air, you can see the temperature ticking up all the time, which really brings home how this is something that's happening right now.
What did she say there? When I heard this today, I fell off my chair. It's brilliant, this.
Even when you're on air, you can see the temperature ticking up all the time, which really brings home how this is something that's happening right now.
I think she said that even when you're on air, you can see the temperature moving up all the time.
Even when you're on air, you can see the temperature ticking up all the time, which really brings home how this is something that's happening right now.
Wow. What kind of fuckery are you? Sky News is going to present a daily climate change show to talk about how, even when she's on air, she can see the temperature going up all the time. I mean, Christ almighty, that is pure horse manure, that. That is undiluted horse manure. Sky News, it's a minute past six, here's them people. With me, Richie Allen. Joining me right soon, Matt Campbell. Don't go anywhere. Heather Small, of course, MP, and moving on up on the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, this Tuesday evening, with you tomorrow and Thursday. Got some very good guests lined up for you between now and the end of the week. Let me remind, I know you know the story, because I know you know all about Matt, but on September 11th, 2001, Jeff Campbell was working in New York City. He was living there with his American fiancé. And kissed her goodbye that morning about 8 o'clock and headed off to a conference at the World Trade Center. And you all know now what happened a short time later. I'm not going to get into that. The planes hitting the towers, 3,000 plus people, lives evaporated basically in the blink of an eye. And the fallout from that and everything that went on thereafter. It was about a year or so later that fragments of a shoulder blade containing Jeff's DNA were found amongst the rubble there. Early on, the family, I suppose, must have suffered dreadfully, not knowing what had happened to him. But it was at that time, a year later, that they began to question the official account of what had happened. And they've not stopped doing that ever since. I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme. It's been ages since he was on. Matt Campbell, Jeff's brother. Matt, welcome back.
Hey, hi Richie. Great to be back.
It's been a long time, mate. How are you? How are things these days?
Yeah, I'm very good. I've just got back into running. I think you did that for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I've been running about 4.5, 5 years now. And I'm addicted to it. How's it going for you?
It was good until I think I've got a little bit of lockdown weight put on, which I've got to get rid of. But enjoying life at the moment.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Sue Reid's piece in the Daily Mail really was what brought it back to me. And that's why I got in touch with you. So I give all credit to Sue for doing the piece and, you know, keeping it in people's minds. We've got all the time you want, by the way, between now and the top of the hour. So as long as you can stay with us and as long as we need, we'll have whatever amount of time we do need. What are your memories? Because it'll be 20 years in September. What are your memories of Jeff as a brother?
It hardly seems possible that it's 20 years. I think for a lot of us, whether it be friends or obviously immediate family, it comes and goes in waves, you know, memories of people who have passed. And I think in particular, the last sort of probably 8 years have probably been harder, just purely because of talking about my brother and the events more than perhaps I was in the previous decade. But certainly, you know, even articles like Sue Reid's piece in the Daily Mail, you know, it stirs stuff up, you know. Both Caroline, that's Jeff's fiance, and my mum, you know, had lengthy chats with Sue. And, you know, it brings stuff back, you know, whether it be memories of the actual day and then the days and the weeks afterwards and stuff, and obviously what we're still continuing to do today, your mind just goes back and you have a mixture of sadness and obviously remembering happy times. I mean, he was a really, you know, great bloke. He was very intelligent, really kind-hearted, you know, really good fun. He'd never have a dull moment with my brother. And, you know, it was all just taken away. And the ripples that his death, you know, caused are still going on and being felt, you know, by a lot of people.
Do you remember, not to dwell on it, I don't want to dwell on it now, but do you remember, everybody remembers where they were on September the 11th if you're over a certain age, so you remember that. And do you remember when you and your mum and Caroline began to wonder, where is he? Is he okay? We can't reach him. Do you remember that?
Well, God, it was chaotic. My wife and two young children were on holiday in Lanzarote. My mum had come out the day before to join us for the final week. And it was just crazy. You know, I think my wife had taken one of the kids out to try and settle in a buggy and saw that something was going on. A lot of people crowded around the TVs at some of the bars that I guess were near the beach and sort of grabbed me to go up and have a look. But it wasn't until probably an hour or so later, we managed to get through to my brother and he'd been in contact with Caroline to really, you know, ascertain that he actually had been at the conference. I'd been off work for, you know, probably about 10 days. So I was kind of a bit out of the loop of what was going on. He'd actually sent me an email that morning, which obviously I hadn't picked up, sent it at like 2 or 3 minutes past eight, saying that he was running late for the Risk Waters conference. I absolutely remember where we were, and, you know, and then it gets slightly fragmented because you know, it was a kind of trauma. I guess it was for a lot of people, but, you know, for us, it was chaotic. You know, we were trying to get flights to go over to New York. Just a lot of stuff happened in those first few days and weeks. And we finally had a wake for him, a memorial, I guess. We didn't have any remains at the end of September. But yeah, going back to your question about, you know, when do we start to question stuff? I guess it was probably primarily me. I had a lot of friends who were, gently nudging and pushing stuff to me. Particularly, I think about the war in Afghanistan just didn't make sense to a lot of people. And the kind of, if I recall correctly, there's almost a buildup of a presence there even prior to 9/11. So there's a great article by John Pilger called "This War Is a Farce," and it was in, you know, reference about the war in Afghanistan. And a friend of mine sent it to me end of October, I think, 2001, and it just started me thinking about an awful lot of stuff that, you know, that didn't sit well with what we were being told.
You began to wonder, well, maybe the story that these hijackers came into the country and took control of these planes and, you know, flew them into those buildings, those three buildings, even though four buildings were damaged, obviously at building seven, which is very contentious as well. You began to wonder, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense when you learn that they were already making moves in Afghanistan. And I suppose later on, they started talking up a war against Iraq, which had nothing to do with September the 11th. And you began to think, well, this makes no sense whatsoever. That can't have been an easy place to be, Matt.
No. And I really struggled. I said, you know, I had good friends who were, sort of saying, you need to look at this. Particularly early days, it was, you know, you should be going after the Saudis. But it really wasn't. It wasn't so much the what happened that day in terms of, you know, the hijacking, the planes, etc. It was more, I guess, the stuff in the background, or the geopolitical stuff, the paper trail stuff that I really looked into. I guess I remember just buying a ridiculous number of books between sort of I think 2003, 2005 was crazy. There's a lot of stuff being published, you know, mainstream as well as alternative takes on stuff. I remember there's a couple of books by a British guy, Nafiz Ahmed, who I think wrote a book called The War on Truth and The War on, I can't remember, something else. And that kind of, again, just started to open my eyes to where 9/11 sat in things.
And wasn't there a brilliant article by Matt Taibbi in the Rolling Stone magazine about insider trading, wasn't there? It was a fantastic bit of journalism, I remember. He was basically the guy that blew the whistle. Correct me if I'm wrong now, because you are the authoritative voice on this. And no, you are. I'm not, you know, you know you are too. You're a terrific researcher. You've done your homework. You've done it for years. But wasn't Taibbi one of the first people to write in, you know, in a major publication about the fact that insider trading led him to believe that people knew in advance that something was going to go down?
Yeah, I mean, that exposure of, you know, absolutely at a minimum foreknowledge, you know, the way that was just crushed and swept aside by the 9/11 Commission report is, you know, is shocking. And there's loads and loads of examples where they just, for me, you know, things should have been pursued, because, you know, paper trail is actually what the authorities are very good at. You know, all the records that, you know, those kind of things can link back to the individuals. And of course, I think the actual records were destroyed, weren't they, at one point?
That's right.
Which the SEC had. But yeah, so for me, it was always paper and just the wars and stuff like that, which, I mean, I even started reading stuff like, so I read a lot of John Pilger's books, you know, just in horror at what us Brits had been up to, and the intelligence services and stuff. But equally, you know, and some people go, oh my God, not him, but also Chomsky, a lot of his stuff.
Yeah.
You know, woke me up to just, you know, manufacturing consent and stuff like that.
So when you were getting into this,
sorry,
Matt, when you were getting into this, yeah. I can't imagine how difficult that must have been for you. It's bad enough you lose your brother, you know, who you love, and you know, you have a very special relationship with him. He's in New York. He's sending you emails. You're very close. You're a tight family. And it's bad enough he's gone, but then you begin to suspect that lies are being told about why he died. And I wonder, how did that impact on your mum and on Caroline at the time? Was that difficult for them? Were there hard conversations, if you don't mind me asking?
I'd say probably most of it was just internal for me, and certainly the poor fools that had to suffer my sort of drunken conversations, right. You know, talking about stuff. But I mean, Caroline, I'll talk about in a sec. But for my mum, we actually moved out to Thailand 2005-2006, and that's where I think I started to shift with some of my views. And so, I mean, for sure, I talked about stuff with my mum. I mean, she lives really local to me. But it wasn't necessarily going to go anywhere. And actually, you know, and I still have this view today. It doesn't. What bugs us as a family, but certainly me, is just not knowing the truth, but also just the way in which the authorities continue to make it really hard. You know, for families in particular to get hold of, you know, evidence which would help lead us to the truth.
I'll come back to that in a minute. That's important.
Yeah.
How the authorities continue to stonewall people like you and the other families. That's important. You were going to mention Caroline, because I didn't know till I read Sue's piece that Caroline lives alone in the apartment that she shared with Jeff, which is sad. And you know, at the same time, it's romantic and it's sad at the same time. How is she today with all of this?
I mean, I'll probably call it tragically romantic. I mean, it is really sad. I mean, I think she, like myself, I've been through a really hard period. You know, say the first decade was really tough. In a conversation when I went over there, 2013, 2014, you know, we sort of found out we were doing the same sort of stuff, just, you know, drinking till the early hours of the morning, just looking for, you know, video footage or a transcript, something that someone's missed, you know, that last image of my brother, and obviously looking at endless video footage and photos of jumpers, you know, which it's not good for your soul or your
no,
mind at all,
Jesus,
doing that
no.
kind of stuff. So, I mean, you know, it's been particularly hard for her, but going, yeah, so talking about conversations and stuff, you know, she, joined the reserves, and I think she did a couple of as she's like a military police, I think she did a couple of stints in Iraq. You know, and it was very hard actually broaching the subject, you know, with her that all is not well. I don't think I really did that.
And did she? It was difficult to broach the subject of a cover-up. So she went into the army, and I've heard this about so many people, out of anger, was it? Out of some desire for retribution.
I don't know what drove her. I mean, I think she comes from a fairly sort of proud background of people being in the army. I mean, her father was,
right.
And you know, so I think there was that desire to serve. I don't know. I mean, it was definitely, you know, there was certainly anger and hatred there to a certain extent. But I don't know if that was still there when she actually was in the military.
Fair enough.
But going back to what I was saying, you know, it was hard to broach the subject with her, you know, and let's say where she is today, she's supporting and she's actually one of the applicants to reopening my brother's inquest. So 20 years on, she wants, you know, my brother's inquest reopened.
Brilliant.
So, you know.
That's hugely important for all of you, because you love her. She was obviously a huge part of your brother's life, and she'll, you know, she'll be very close to you as well. We're speaking with Matt Campbell. Now, I know you know who Matt is, because Matt, obviously incredibly well known, because he's been, along with his family, trying to get to the bottom of what really happened on September 11th, 2001. His brother Jeff was only 31 at the time. He had it all going for him, Jeff. God love him. And he was in World Trade Center building when it all happened. He was there for a conference. And a year later, they had a wake in September, Matt told us earlier. But a year later, they found a fragment of a bone that was DNA traced to be Jeff's, basically. And ever since then, well, a couple of years later, as Matt has been explaining, he began to realise that all wasn't well and began following a paper trail, which not only suggested but proved that all wasn't well and that a lot of answers had not been given. And how did you feel? I read the 9/11 Commission report. It took me a long time, but I read every bit of it. When the author or the editor of it, Thomas Keane, the lawyer, when he said at the end of that journey, when he was given $3 million to investigate September the 11th, and I think the first time we spoke, we kind of laughed at the fact that $50 million was given to investigate whether or not Bill Clinton had oral sex in the Oval Office with an intern, which is, you know, by the by, doesn't mean anything to anybody. But they gave $3 million to Thomas Keane. And didn't he write a book about the whole process where he said that it was set up to fail? How did you feel? I'm not trying to get an emotional response out of you, Matt, because I know I won't, and it's not about that. But when the guy comes out and says to the families, listen, this whole thing was basically nonsense, how did you feel about that?
I mean, you expect, I mean, I've been brought up to, you know, to believe that the authorities, you know, whether it be police, the courts, etc., you know, there's some kind of fair trial and there's a proper investigation. And that, I mean, there's a couple of real key comments that he made. One was, yeah, set up to fail. And I think it was. I think it was a political nightmare to try and to get to the bottom of what went on, because there's just so many conflicts of interest with the people actually within the commission, with the Bush government, that, you know, it was always going to be a hard task. But I mean, there's other things in the 9/11 commission report that you know, Keane and Hamilton wrote as well, which is about the hijackers, the confessions extracted and the torture,
yeah,
of people that were obviously shipped off to Guantanamo, amongst other places. And, you know, I don't know, two chapters of the book are based on essentially, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques, which obviously is torture. I think some paper analysed the footnotes. 25% of the footnotes for that report are based on these interrogations. And, you know, they have a disclaimer at the beginning of the start of these two chapters saying that, you know, they not only were they not present, they weren't even allowed to set up the questions. They weren't allowed to ask questions after answers had been given to whatever questions they had been asked. They played no part, and they had to take everything at face value that was given to them by the CIA, obviously torturing these guys. And the most astounding thing for me is the fact that, apart from the fact tapes were destroyed, which again, I think Kean Hamilton actually wrote about, I remember picking up on that in one of the newspaper articles, that, I think maybe 100 or 180 tapes had been destroyed. And that kind of, that's the whole thing with that is just bizarre, because it turns out that it was the, one of the guys who was tortured was the kind of first guy that they actually picked up. I can't remember his name is, it'll come back to me. But, in 2008 or whatever, 2009, they admitted that he never had been part of Al-Qaeda. And yet he was supposed to be Bin Laden's first lieutenant.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating, but particularly that comment by the people that headed the commission, it's in the book. It's almost like, well, we can't rely on these two chapters, but they actually make the bulk of all the evidence, around Al-Qaeda and all the rest of it is based on that torture.
Yeah.
I guess I expected more. I think almost all the families, even those, the ones that had, attended almost every single hearing in the States, expected more. But, it was a whitewash. It was, there's some great quotes by some of the family members, it was just accolades being given out. It was a story that they'd already crafted, and they kind of made everything fit that narrative. That's not to say that all that narrative is false. It was just, it wasn't what I'd expect from a proper investigation. No.
God only knows what it must have been like.
And they didn't have the money as well.
The money, I mean, the $3 million, I mean, that was a slap in the face to the families of those who died on September 11th. Matt Campbell is our guest. This is really important, what you're hearing now. It really is, because, 20 years later, there's a generation or two behind us, and it won't mean as much to them as it means to us. They'll presumably learn about it in history, and they'll be told the official version of events, which is complete nonsense. And it's important for me, because I reported on it live as it was happening on the day, and I bought into all the lies, and I broadcast those lies, me and my presenter. We told people that a madman in a cave had orchestrated this attack on the World Trade Center buildings and on the Pentagon. So it's important that we talk about this. Matt Campbell and his family, for years and years and years now, have refused to accept the official version of events. And we're going to talk about the big news that I wasn't aware of until I read Sue's piece. We'll talk about that in a moment. But I suppose every time something happened, like the formation of Architects and Engineers. Now, I know it's a controversial group. And I know that in the independent media, not everybody is thrilled or enamoured of all of the men and women involved. But I've known Richard Gage for years. I've had him on various programmes. I see Richard Gage as a genuine man. I can't ignore that you've got thousands of people who've worked in building design and building construction, and including many hundreds of men and women who've worked in building demolition. And they came together and said, listen, in our expert opinion, the planes couldn't have brought down these buildings. When things like that happened, Matt, that must have been very exciting for the families, but then ultimately very much of a letdown. Do you know what I'm getting at? It must have been great to see all of these people come out, these experts, and say, look, no, this is wrong. But then I suppose a bit disappointing, because ultimately the things that you might have expected to happen as a result of Architects and Engineers didn't happen. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of, I said, not really focused on, obviously enough, the
physical
the
stuff.
The towers collapsed and stuff like that, because it's more paperwork and the walls and stuff. But, obviously I was aware of, not all, but a lot of the various groups that were forming and popping up. But I never really paid much attention to Building 7. I was aware of it when the, report came out, and obviously a little bit prior to that. But it never had a lot of interest for me, just purely because my brother wasn't in the building and he didn't die. And it wasn't probably until, 2009, 2010, that I really gave any sort of serious thought to.
Is that right? Now that
the controlled demolition. Yeah,
you've probably said that to me before, but I've forgotten. I'm amazed that it 8-9 years later before you think about Building 7. Sorry, I'm interrupting you. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
No. So it just wasn't my focus. I guess it wasn't where I was at. Learning more, not just from market engineers, there's plenty of other people, you know, pointed towards, you know, things to do specifically with the way that the buildings came down. But it wasn't really until I came back from Thailand into what if it was 2000, end of 2011, 2012. And then in Tony Rook's court case in 2013, in February, I think it was, that was when I actually connected with people who, and obviously Tony had used a lot of evidence that architect engineers had put together.
Remind our listeners about Tony, please, if you don't mind, Matt. Yeah, so, remind about Tony.
Yes, I mean, I've actually done the same action, but Tony Rook basically was refusing to pay his TV licence for the main reason was that the BBC continuing to lie, not tell the truth, in particular about Building 7. And, you know, he felt lots of reasons why, but basically he shouldn't be paying the BBC because basically you're effectively doing the purposes of terrorism because they are allowing, you know, the truth of about Building 7 in particular not to be known. I met him for his court. I mean, God knows how I managed to squeeze in. It was only 20 minutes up the road, so I got there early, managed to get into the courtroom. But, you know, Tony kind of was let off. I think he had a conditional discharge, but no fine, which is almost unheard of. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't pay his TV license today. But so I met a few characters afterwards. So obviously I met Tony. Niels Harriott had come over to give evidence, but, you know, never actually got, wasn't allowed to. And anyway, that was my kind of, I guess, first experience of meeting people face to face, because I hadn't really spoken in public prior to 2013. So going back to what you're talking about, architecture engineers. So my frustration actually with groups like architect engineers was probably no more than just a frustration of, I always felt, this is probably around 2014, that the one way in which we can actually get this evidence in court, rather than don't think it'll ever go anywhere in the States, you know, is we have this peculiar thing in the UK, which is, you know, if someone's died, they have an inquest. Okay, my brother had the inquest and it was all official narrative stuff. But there is a mechanism whereby if you, you know, can convince the Attorney General that there's a lot of evidence that wasn't presented or considered by the coroner at the first inquest, or there was an insufficiency of investigation, you know, that you can put forward a case for the Attorney General to reopen that inquest. And so for me, it was always like, this is the quickest way of getting this, you know, large amount of evidence into a court floor. It just took a long time, I think, to convince them. And in order, you know, because they're the best. I did actually start a small fundraising thing myself to do a little foray with the barrister to see, you know, if it had any legs, what I was trying to do. But, you know, it became very clear, you know, we're talking, and as it ended up being, $100,000 that we needed to raise. And so I couldn't really do that without an organization like A&E. And, you know, by and large, not using exclusively their stuff, but, you know, a lot of their stuff will, you know, be in the application. So it was just a frustration. I just thought, you know, there's all these various things going off. And, you know, I know there had been some legal attempts over in the States, but it was just like, for me, is actually inquest is tailor-made for architects, engineers, evidence, because an inquest is really narrow in scope. It's only really about how that person died.
Yeah.
It's not anything else. It's not talking about hijackers, planes, you know, all the surrounding others. It's just nothing to do with that. It's just purely how did he come about his death, basically.
And if he didn't, if he didn't die because planes brought a building down, on their own, but if he died because explosives had been placed in those buildings, that should be of interest to anybody determining whether to reopen the inquest into Jeff's death. So that's obviously a big thing for you.
Yeah, I mean, and absolutely. And the coroner actually applied a kind of, they're allowed to give narratives when they sum up the cause of death. And they very specifically, she very specifically said that, you know, it was the impact of A11 into the North Tower, which ultimately caused its collapse. So it's in there. So we're challenging that, basically. Yes, it was Moses' incendiary that brought down the towers, obviously, directly or indirectly, led to my brother's death.
Now, your legal representatives, from what I read in Sue's piece, they're optimistic about your chances of having a new inquest into what happened to Jeff open up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, I don't think they're kind of allowed to give an opinion of it. I mean, Nick's, the barrister's always said, you know, he wouldn't put forward an application unless he wasn't confident that would be able to, to get the authority given by the Attorney General to reopen the inquest. But I mean, us as a family, you know, we're very confident. I mean, as part of this kind of process, we've looked at, previous applications to the Attorney General, where they succeeded, where they failed. And from my layman's point of view, we've got way more evidence, insufficiency of inquiry, that, you know, it should be a slam dunk. She absolutely no issue at all with the Attorney General, granting her, well, it's not her, she's, Suella Braveman's actually on maternity leave now. It's actually Michael Ellis, who, oddly enough, is the MP for Northampton North, and that's where we grew up as kids, in Northampton.
Wow.
So for me, very, very hopeful. You know, so all things being equal, and let's just assume that the legal system is all good and above board. I don't see why we would have a problem not getting the authority. And then the interesting thing here, Richie, is if we do get the authority, which is absolutely key to get it from the Attorney General, once it gets pushed to the High Court, we're 99.9% sure that there's never been a single case where the High Court hasn't quashed an inquest and pushed it to the Coroner's Court and said reopen a new one. So, on paper, this should be in a Coroner's Court within, however long, probably a year or two.
So it could be a year or two. So from today then, so it could be 2022, early 2023 then, if something happens.
It's really hard. I mean, quickest time, we could be talking, early next year would be, if Brilliant. Everything goes really quickly. But it is, what we know from the application, but what the Barrett said, it's quite a complex case. The Attorney General is going to have to get quite a few teams of different technical people to look at the evidence. So, I don't think it's going to be that kind of 6 weeks, 3 months.
And you've been
get looked at.
You've been for years and years now. This has been obviously such a massive part of your life, and here we are now, 20 years since then. Have you been able to, because it was nice at the beginning of our conversation, you said that you're in a good place, that you're in great form, which is lovely to hear. So you've managed to mourn Jeff and to deal with that and to have a life yourself and to have a good life and park the inquest-related activities when you're not doing them and get on with your life. Have you been able to do that? And how important, Matt, has it been to be able to do that?
I did actually take a break from stuff. It was all getting a bit crazy. So I kind of sort of stopped, I think, towards the end of 2016, 2018. I kind of just, I really did down tools. I needed a break. And I think one of the things that I made really clear when I first spoke with Ted Walter from A&E, and indeed when we first started having meetings with the barrister, was I didn't want to get overly involved. So although I am obviously involved, it's not anywhere near to the extent that I thought I'd have to be. This is when I was doing my own fundraising back in, whenever it was, 2016. Because it is consuming, and I didn't want it to be. So I'm in a much better place. The bumpiness and the madness of the first decade have definitely I've done a lot of healing since sort of 2013, which has helped me to be in the place that I am right now to deal with it. Not kind of matter of fact, but it's just I can switch it on and switch it off. That said, it is getting busier at the moment, partly because we're about to submit, and I'm kind of assuming that it may get really interesting and busy should we actually get the authority given by the Attorney General. It's a huge can of worms, you know, for both the UK and US authorities, I'm sure.
Well, of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, where I am on it, not that it makes any difference to you, and it's really nobody's business, but I haven't spoken about it for a long time. I haven't. I don't believe that the planes brought the buildings down. I don't believe that a group of jihadis were operating a sleeper cell in New York and in other parts of the country, determined to bring down those buildings. I don't believe any of it. Now, when I'm asked then to put forward a position, I don't, because I don't know. And I wish more people in, you know, who want to be in broadcasting and journalism would just be honest about it. You might suspect this or you might suspect that, but really you don't know. All I think I know is that the buildings didn't come down because of the planes. We're getting a lot of tweets on it. I don't believe that. I believe, like yourself, I believe that the immediate reaction by the United States and by the UK and by France and other countries gave the game away, you know, in terms of invading Iraq and all that went with that. I mean, I'll never forget, Matt, I was in Spain some years ago and I met a couple of different pilots. One of them was a lovely old retired pilot and he spoke to me about UFOs, would you believe? He was a lovely gentleman. Had been an Aer Lingus captain for the best part of 40 years. We chatted about one or two things. And I asked him about the World Trade Center. And while he didn't get into that in great detail, what he did say to me was, he said, well, I can tell you this much, Richie. The flight plan that we were told occurred in Washington, in D.C., whereby Hanjour, I think his name was, where he descended out of the sky and crashed into the Pentagon. He said, I can tell you that didn't happen. I know it didn't happen, he said, because it's impossible. I've looked at that flight plan and how he made those manoeuvres, it didn't happen. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And he said, a number of pilots have attempted to reconstruct that in simulators. It's impossible. The plane stalls and falls out of the sky. But he wouldn't be drawn then on anything else. He just said, I don't believe that. So that's where I've always been on it. You know, I believe that. No, I'm not going to say any more. That's how I've always felt on that day. And I felt very guilty afterwards for not asking more questions when I was working in commercial radio at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. What about you? Do you have to park to one side your own theories, or do you have a theory as to who benefited most from it? And is that something that you discuss, Matt?
Well, not, I mean, obviously.
Not in terms of the inquest anyway.
No, for the inquest, no. I mean, it's outside the scope. I mean, the one thing that I has always sort of struck me, because I do my own freedom of information requests. You know, I've been relentless in trying to extract stuff from the authorities. I mean, right now, for example, I'm debating whether to pay, I think they're asking $600 for a possibly 15,000 pages, or nearly 16,000 pages, of material that's garnered as part of the Joint Intelligence Committee inquiry, which I think the report came out in 2002, which led to the infamous 28 pages. So they've got, you know, some 16,000 pages that haven't been released on all the background stuff to do with the Saudis. For me, I always think there's three aspects that, you know, it's murky and it's to do with intelligence. So, you know, my dad's part of the Motley Rice Saudi lawsuit. And I know there's a Kreindler and Kreindler lawsuit. You know, without doubt, the Saudis gave material support. That's both intelligence, money, all sorts of stuff. I mean, you know, it's on record.
It's on the record, and, yeah.
You know, we've only seen bits and pieces in the 28 pages, but, you know, there's for me, that's a given. You then have the really awkward, again, how the hell do the American authorities deal with it? The CIA actively protecting at least two of the alleged hijackers. That's Al Hazmi and Al Mindar. And Al Mindar is amazing. He was wanted. He's on the wanted list for the USS Cole bombing. And yet, you know, they allowed him into the US. And then, you know, and basically the FBI were prevented from knowing anything about these two characters being in the country. And then, of course, we get to, and I'd say at a minimum, the foreknowledge of Israel's Mossad.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of for me, it's so murky. And here's something that
Can I ask you about that before you move on? Can I ask you about that before you finish that thought? Because I'll be accused. I don't know why I get accused, because I give Israel a horrible bashing on this program regularly. I have no time for the country or how it operates. But anyway, I'll be hammered if I don't say this. I've never been comfortable with the dancing Israelis either. And I've mulled that over in my head time and time and time and time again. And friends of mine say, oh, Israel did it, Richie. And I'm like, well, look, if there was a neocon move towards starting and, promoting wars in the Middle East, they wouldn't have needed Israel or anybody else to do it. But I've often thought about the dancing Israelis, and the best I can come up with is that you said foreknowledge of Mossad. The best I can come up with is that they were intelligence gathering and that they were there maybe to document it. Knowing that it was going to happen, I don't know. But if I didn't mention it, I'd be absolutely hammered for not mentioning it.
No, sure.
What do you think?
So, the urban moving system, that's what I was referring to. You know, the company and the people that work for them, of which some of them were Mossad. But, I mean, here's what I mean by the murky world of intelligence. So Ziad Jarrah, who was one of the alleged hijackers on UA-93, his first cousin, Ali Jarrah, was arrested in the Lebanon in 2009, accused of being a 25-year-old Mossad spy.
Right.
And now, if you take and believe everything that Al-Qaeda's thrown at us and the family connections between Ramzi Youssef, the World Trade Center bomber from 1993, his uncle is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the principal architect being held at Guantanamo, there's a lot of stuff that's kept in the family. So you've got a situation here where the first cousin of one of the hijackers on UA-93 is Mossad. The mind boggles. The mind absolutely boggles for me. So I don't know. I don't go in. I don't.
No, it's difficult, really, isn't it? You know, we had that here in Manchester. We had that here in Manchester. The guy who allegedly blew up the foyer at the Manchester Arena and killed 22 people was Al Abadi is his name. Salman Al Abadi, that's the guy. They recently convicted his brother of providing him support in that. But his old man, Ramadan Al Abadi, basically worked for MI6 in Libya, trying to bring down Gaddafi. Now, that can either be something or nothing, but it's the sort of stuff that should be investigated by our governments.
Yeah.
And what you've just been talking to me should be investigated, and it should be uncovered, Dreadful stuff.
It's just murky, isn't it? It's that murky world of intelligence.
And,
so going back to the CIA, protecting those two guys, I mean, the only plausible excuse that I think they could ever come up with is that they were trying to turn them, to be spies for the CIA, but it's quite a push to go with that, when one of the guys is what was wanted for the USS Cole bombing. But anyway, so there's lots of stuff that I'm frustrated that there doesn't seem to have been a proper investigation. The media certainly haven't been all over it as much as they should have.
They never did from the start. The media never media never touched it. It never went near it. When I think back, the media basically read the briefings. They rewrote the briefings and read them as news. There was never any serious questions about any of it. Like Taibbi's report on the dodgy insider trading, where United Airlines and American Airlines stock was traded to, put options were made, bets were made that it was going to fall dramatically.
Yeah.
And dozens of times more than usual. Bets were made dozens of times. You know, my position, I mean, I didn't articulate my position well earlier on, not that it matters, is somebody wanted to get the people of the United States and the people of the West to support ongoing wars in the Middle East. And I think September the 11th was that... I'm going to say false flag event that was used to get the public to back these illegal wars that have cost God knows how many lives, Matt. I have no idea. Since then. And as you said, you could have multiple countries involved in that. Multiple. You could have the Saudis involved. The French might have been involved. The Israelis might have been involved. Our country here might have been involved.
Who knows? It's such a murky world.
But all that matters to you and your family, I'm hearing from you, and I've heard from you in the past days, is ultimately it was declared that your brother Jeff died because planes were driven into the World Trade Center building. That caused the steel to melt, and that led to your brother's death. And that is, to me, that's patently nonsense. And you're entitled to have that inquest opened again and to have that information put before whoever gets to hear that inquest. That's what it's about, really. All these things about, you know, I mean, I get it all the time. Oh, Richie, there was no planes. Oh, Richie, there was an energy weapon. It doesn't matter a damn any of that. It really doesn't, really. What matters is what you can prove and what you can get a judge to listen to. And, I mean, I don't believe that there were no planes. I know that some of my guests of yesteryear believe that, but I don't buy that for a minute. Planes hit those buildings. Who was driving those planes? I don't know. Is there any truth, Matt, to the claim that some of the alleged hijackers who are supposedly dead because they crashed into the buildings, that some of those guys are still alive and well? Is there any truth in that?
I from what I've read, I think it was just chaos and poor reporting. I mean, you know, journalists, God bless, Richie, you know, you've obviously been in that world before. You know, you're under pressure, and I guess you just, not sloppy, but, you know, you make mistakes. So even in, you know, God bless the Stu Reed's piece, you know, it's yeah, riddled with, you know, minor, but for me, they're niggly errors, you know? And I mean, that for me is, it's something that, it's no different to the, I'm not going to mention, I don't want to be contentious, but, you know, something gets presented either as incomplete information or it's, you know, it's just unfortunately misinformation, and then that sticks and it never goes away, even though there's bucket loads of evidence to counteract those initial views that people took. And that for me is a little bit of my frustration with, you know, the endless memes that are kicked around and stuff, you know. But going back to hijackers, you know, which obviously is a key part, if I wanted to really, you know, focus, and I have tried to focus on, you know, the individuals that have been you know, made accountable, or held, been accused, rather, to say, of killing my brother. You know, the pilots and the crew that are on AA-11, the plane that hit the North Tower. You know, even though I believe they probably were on there, it'd be kind of stupid if you were to not have patsies. You know, but I've been frustrated not to be able to get hold of the authenticated flight manifest. And that doesn't mean that they don't exist. It's just, again, it's that whole you have with the authorities trying to get hold of official records. I do actually have the flight manifest. I made a request. You have to be really specific when you do FOIs. And there was a reference to something that had been scanned into concordance and it had a serial number and a reference. And I sent off my request and I actually got that back. And they pretty much match the copy of the manifest that are floating around the internet, which were released by a law firm representing the families and a publisher. But, you know, to my knowledge, that's the first time that anything's actually been released by the FBI, but it isn't the authenticated one. But then, you know, I've been to Guantanamo, and my conversation there with one of the prosecution lawyers was, you know, do you guys have it? You know, the authenticated you know, flight manifesto of the hijackers. And he said, yeah, it was one of the first bits of just what they call boring paper that was submitted to the judge and the defense. And so for me, the only reason why I think the FBI plausibly are saying that they can't give me the records, the actual authenticated ones, is because they keep saying it's part of an ongoing investigation.
Right.
And so the only thing I think was going on is obviously the Gitmo. Now, I don't know, you know, I don't think the guy's lying, you know, but obviously until that trial goes public and until those exhibits get put up, you know, I'm still frustrated. 20 years on, I don't have that kind of boring, fundamental evidence.
Hugely important.
And that's always been a frustration for me, you know. And, you know, and if, even though if it produced, I'm sure people say they're fakes and all the rest of it, but it's like, it just, parts of the stuff that's out there, you know, in I guess you'd call it, you know, that C word with a T at the end, the second word.
Yeah.
You know, my frustration is that, you know, a lot of it is almost, it's encouraged because they deliberately withhold information. So, of course, your mind starts to think of reasons why and, you know, and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of frustration, but I said, for me, the inquest is very, very focused. I don't, I mean, just, you know, on record, I guess, I don't blame the coroner for, you know, not doing her job properly. I mean, she could only deal with what was presented in front of her. And so, you know, if anyone's to blame from the British side, it's basically, you know, the Met Police and SO15, you know, counterterrorism people, which I actually met the officer who prepared the report for my for the joint inquest. And, you know, it's frustrating. He didn't know about an awful lot of stuff, or at least made out he didn't know. So he didn't know about Building 7 and stuff like that. You know, it's frustrating because I don't feel that, you know, everyone's done their bit in trying to get to, you know, whether it be justice or at least truth.
You're back to murky.
Everyone else has died. Say again?
You're back to murky again, aren't you? You're back to agencies, yeah. Different multiple agencies, of course, and task forces and people not sharing information and then orders coming from various people ahead of them to not go down this road and shut up about that. And I mean, it's one of the biggest things that it's the most important event in my lifetime, really, you know. And look, when I say I hope that the inquest is opened, that he gets a proper inquest, obviously I mean that. I'm glad that you and the family and Caroline are optimistic about that. And I hope that in the very near future, you'll be coming back on to tell us that you've got good news. That'll be brilliant, Matt. Is there anything?
I'd love to, Richie.
Oh, it'd be amazing. But I'm not going to cut you off. Is there anything that our listeners can do for you at all? Is there anything they can help with? If there is, now is the time to tell us.
I think it's to help get the word out. I would hate to have a situation that is it the family of Martin Luther King, who they did the civil trial against the government and Lloyd Jowers, and they found that they were actually responsible and had conspired to murder him. And, you know, there was one reporter in the room and barely a ripple went out. So for me, it's to share the news that, you know, this, when this does actually get submitted, that it's actually in the system. But then obviously if the news is good or bad, is to, again, to share that. You know, it's all family members who have to fight for truth and justice. You know, Hillsborough, Bloody Sunday, you know, it has to ultimately come from us. Bloody Sunday, they only started 20 years on. So I've still got.
That's right,
that,
you know, that's right. Yeah, there might be something in that. There might be something in it. It was great to have you back on the programme, Matt. It's been ages. Look, whatever this programme can do to remind people when it is submitted and to alert people to the fact that it's submitted in the system, obviously I'm happy for you to come back on and tell us at that time and to talk about it and to write about it. And you've got plenty of friends in the independent media who've got very big reach. We've got a very big reach as well, and I'm sure they'll do the same, mate. So just the absolute best of luck, all fingers and toes crossed for you and your family. You've never given up, and that's an amazing thing, mate, that you haven't given up. I can't imagine what it must be like, and nobody can. We've all lost people that mean everything to us, but not many of us know what it's like to lose somebody to a wrongful death, and you do, and yet you keep going, you and your family. So the best of luck to you. If you want the last 30 seconds, Matt, I'll give you the last 30 seconds. Godspeed to you and your family.
No, cheers, Richie. All I'd say is, yeah, absolutely. Please have me back on when we've got more news of where this inquest is going.
Of course, mate. You have an open door. Cheers. Don't wait to be asked. Thanks for everything, Matt. Thanks for coming back today.
Bye for now. Take care.
Bye for now. That's the lovely Matt Campbell. And great to have Matt back on. I know he means a lot to you, as does his family. His brother Jeff was wrongfully killed in New York City on September 11, 2001. The truth has never come out, really. A lot of people think they know the truth. We know that the official story is nonsense. And Matt and family and Caroline, Matt's fiance, want justice and they want answers and they want a new inquest into Matt's death. And we wish them all the very best with that. That closes out Tuesday's programme. Thanks again to Matt. Thanks to you for listening. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 5 o'clock UK time, as usual, with Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Until then, I'm leaving you with this from Christopher Cross. And this is Arthur's theme. Thanks for being with me today. Bye for now. Bye.
Once in your life, you find her. Someone who turns.